We were in the midst of the exploitation discussion. Let's see, where I left off was, let's see here. Classical Marxist ideas. We got through all of the specific concepts around it, right? We did absolute relative surplus value, right?
Yeah, we were onto the rethinking exploitation stuff.
Yeah, I just want to be sure did I finish everything with the other part? I guess so. Are there any questions? As I said, I think in the first lecture, at the very beginning of each lecture, if there are specific questions that after the previous lecture you had that you wanted to raise, we can spend a few minutes on that. It's also a way to have a little bit of review to get back into the material. So, were there any follow-up questions from the last week's discussion? All right. So let's go on. Yeah.
Just on, you're talking about that energy theory of value.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that, like, if you accept some of the recent sort of defenses of labor theory of value, especially the formula of profit, then I was thinking that if you compare like an energy theory of value to, say, a labor theory of value, and you have different sort of empirical predictions. So economizing, if you assume energy is the value numerair, the value substance, then economizing on energy will generate a falling rate of profit, as opposed to economizing on labor. So in that sense,
but I don't think it actually would lead to different expectations, because you can always transform one of these into the other. So long as both energy and labor are inputs into all outputs, you can simply mathematically transform one theory of value into another by just iterating. That is, if every output that we ever produce takes a certain number of calories of energy plus a certain amount of labor time, but that's an input to every output, there's a conversion rate between the two, and you can simply mathematically turn one into the other. So any thesis that applies to one should apply to the other. Certainly in terms of directions of change, I can't see... It's the case for an energy theory of value that unless you have surplus energy, you have a zero rate of profit. Mm-hmm. Unless you have surplus value, labor value, you have a zero rate of profit, because if all labor is simply used to produce labor, there's nothing left over for a surplus, and if all energy is simply used to produce energy, there's nothing left over. And any expression in terms of the labor intensity or the energy intensity of production can be, you can turn the energy intensity into a certain labor intensity because of the amount of labor that's embodied.
Don't you need to pick one? Like I was thinking specifically about like a peanut theory of value or something. Right. Like, don't you have to specifically pick one, like the peanut, like the peanut is your value numerair or something?
Well, you can do it one by one, or you can do what some people have argued, is to take kind of weighted average of all the inputs and create a concocted abstract input called the standard commodity, the standard unit, which is simply a weighted average of all inputs, and use that as your, what's called the value numeraire, that expression, value numeraire. This is a technical kind of classical economics Marxian type term. It simply means whatever is the metric, the measure by which you measure the value of things. So prices are a metric for measuring value. It's one way of doing it. Some notion of the real costs of production is another way of doing it. So that expression, the real costs of production, that corresponds to a perfectly intuitive notion of value. So we all think of things are really valuable if they cost a lot to produce. If they took a lot of time, effort, and resources to produce, they'll be expensive. If they didn't take much cost to produce, they'd be cheap. So all value theory is somehow or other trying to tap into some notion of the costs of production. And what they're trying to do is to find something that they, you could call the real costs of production, the true deep costs of production, that doesn't rely simply on whatever the prices of the inputs happen to be at any given time. The notion of a cost of production fundamentally is about the scarcity of inputs. That is, you use, we have a natural world and you can use the inputs in different ways. And there are, again using a economic speak, there are opportunity costs for using inputs in one way rather than another. And what it means for a resource to be more or less valuable is how substitutable is that input for other inputs, and what are the opportunities that are foregone when you use it for one thing or another. So if you take a, let's just take as an example, a metal that's extremely valuable, extremely useful for making fancy electronics. Platinum, I guess, is used in certain kinds of electronics and other things. And you decided to build a bridge with platinum. Somebody would say, that's unbelievably wasteful. There's so many more useful things you could do with it. If you're going to build a bridge, you're just wasting vast amounts of this incredibly valuable resource. Well, that's because it's particularly scarce. If you say, I want to use air to make steel, and somebody says, are you crazy? We need air to make food. How can you use this all for steel? And you say, are you crazy? It's free. Well, what does free mean? There's no opportunity cost using it for one thing or another. Okay. So a cost of production idea is always ultimately about the natural scarcity of things. Natural meaning that you have, there's trade-offs in how you use them. For air, there are no trade-offs. For platinum, there are huge trade-offs. And then you want to have a way of tapping the magnitude. What the labor theory of value says is the reason why platinum is valuable is it takes a hell of a long time to find it. So the natural scarcity in the ground is measured by the number of human hours it takes to find the stuff. And you know, and refine it and all the other things that go into it. Well, that's, you can do it that way, but I think, I don't think there's compelling arguments for why the only thing that ultimately renders something scarce is the fact that we have to allocate human time differentially to their production and finding it. And if you then just sort of relax about this problem and say we have a cost of production view of value, and it's rooted in the scarcities of things, including time, but other natural scarcities, and also scarcities over time. You know, there's the very interesting and complicated problem about the present cost of something relative to its future scarcity that has to do with the fact that energy, for example, is never properly priced with respect to future uses, which is why we deplete, one of the reasons why we deplete the resource so rapidly. If you just relax about this and say all we really want is a cost-based theory of prices and of the value of things, then there's no, I don't think there's a compelling reason to make the additional step and say, oh, and by the way, the only cost that is really fundamental is human time. Now, if it were true that the only cost that was fundamental was human time, and that explained, there was actually a causal mechanism by which that explained the relative costs of all the inputs of production, then of course we should advocate such a view. You know, if it was a scientifically correct identification of the causal mechanism involved. But for reasons that have been endlessly debated and in very obscure ways, that makes it pretty intractable for anyone who is not prepared to learn a lot of mathematics and get deeply into these debates. Some people say this is all nonsense, that there is absolutely no reason why labor is the only scarcity that matters. And other people say, no, of course it is, and here's the mathematics to prove it. And since I'm certainly not prepared to learn the mathematics to sort out the technical details myself to see if I think it's the derivations are persuasive. But also because I believe clever mathematicians can demonstrate anything and hide very obscure assumptions about the nature of the functions they're using in ways that are really inaccessible. I'm just extremely skeptical about all this work that's been done, all this new transformation theory debate. Furthermore, if it is the case that you have to go through that degree of esoteric sophistication to understand this, then its political relevance seems to be zero.
That's what originally turned the tide, wasn't it? It was Stegman and like all the mathematical Marxists that sort of using highly formalized models basically convinced everybody.
What they did is convince most of us that it wasn't worth worrying about. Because we can't sort out what they did, and we can't sort out what their critics do. And all of the things we used labor theory of value to explain, all of the explanatory punch came from things other than what they were fighting about. It came from the social relations between labor and capital that led to forms of domination and control over laboring activity. And we cared about that. We care about human effort being performed and being controlled by other people and not being under the autonomous and democratic control of the producers. There's all sorts of things we care about, but none of them required solving the transformation problem. This came up in the discussion this morning. Some people would argue that the labor theory of value helps workers understand their exploitation. And I don't think it does at all. I think the labor theory of value obscures exploitation to workers. I mean, the transformation part, these esoteric things. Because what it means is, since of course workers aren't going to understand the transformation problem, if highfalutin academics with basic sophisticated mathematics, but not super sophisticated mathematics, can't track these discussions, workers aren't going to be able to either, because it's really hard stuff. So the only reason they're going to believe the labor theory of value is because they believe the person who tells them to believe it. That is, they have trust in the intellectuals who are saying this is the way the world works. But that depends then on their views about exploitation hinging on their trust of the person talking to them. That was characteristic of the way communist parties organized their schools for workers and their ideology formation. Depended heavily upon the charismatic authority, if you will, to use sociological terms, of the speaker. And that's a pretty precarious basis on which to forge understanding. Yeah.
And why is it relevant for workers? Is it liberal for workers to understand a theory of exploitation that's to bring about class consciousness?
I think it's important for workers to understand the nature of the conflicts which they feel in their common sense with their bosses, and the character of that conflict, having the particular forms of interdependence that I try to map directly, that is that the welfare of the capitalist is causally connected to my deprivations, and that they have an interest in keeping me vulnerable. That seems to me the stuff that you can explain directly to people, and that's the stuff that underwrites a desire to transform those relations. As opposed to saying, in addition, the rate of profit measured in prices is a function through a complicated set of mathematical transformations of the abstract socially necessary labor time that I have contributed to production. I don't see what that adds to the characterization of the conflict as being bound by these interdependencies. I have those three.
And then, it gets into a discussion of what is the theory, is the theories we're developing in this course, for example, or that have been developed in what we're reading, are they serving as a construct for developing a radical egalitarian society, or are they serve a pedagogical focus for class consciousness? Not to say that the two are mutually exclusive, but
I hope not.
Yeah, not to say that the two are mutually exclusive, but you know, to say that we can't develop a certain amount of complexity because it doesn't, it's not pedagogically viable. But,
you know. Oh, no, no, no. I would not, yes, yeah, so I would not want to make the claim that because it's not pedagogically viable, it's wrong. It could be correct and not pedagogically viable. But if I can't figure out whether or not it's correct because it's too hard, and the debates and the people on both sides of the debate I trust in the sense of I see their values, I feel they're both on the side of, neither one is trying to obscure things for bad motives, as far as I can tell. So I don't have any basis for distinguishing. And I don't see its relevance to anything that I've tried to study. Then I just bracket, that's why I would just bracket the debate and say it's not necessary to move forward. Which it's not necessary to move forward given the agenda of research and writing that I have. It could be necessary for some agendas. People seem to keep fighting about this. I thought the fights were more or less petering out in the late 70s, early 80s, and they're still going on. On occasion, I've been in conferences and in discussions where these things get, you know, presented on panels, and I've seen some defenders of the transformation problem who I, in fact, think are arguing dishonestly. They present data to support their views, which they know is not right. You know, so that's kind of dishonest presentation. But, you know, that's just a given person. It doesn't imply that the theory is necessarily wrong. Rob.
I have two comments. The first one is, when you dismiss the transformation problem and the broader scope of Marx's contributions, I think that to some extent you might just limit his contributions to the ground or to the factory without expanding it to the broader understanding of economic dynamics. And my second comment relates to when you dismiss the transformation problem and the labor theory of value, you might not give a substantive alternative to how the worker can understand his exploitation. If you only say that his exploitation is a relation to his boss and not to specify the measure of how that relationship works and to give the dynamics, the substantive dynamics that occur in that relationship.
Okay, so let me.
It sounds very abstract. I think that obscures.
But right, but if you use the labor theory of value, then you can be put yourself in the position of saying that the most privileged workers are the most exploited. You know, you could get to that situation. The most privileged workers are the most exploited. The least privileged workers are less exploited because of the transformation problem, and it has exactly the opposite normative implications in terms of mobilization, and in terms of a sense of linking a lived experience, which is that the least privileged workers are the most oppressed.
You mean most privileged workers are sort of like who have skills or able to lessen
their exploitation? No. It's because the most privileged workers are contributing more value to more abstract labor to production. You know, because of the multiplying, I mean, this is part of the transformation problem involves this, again, very esoteric debate as to whether high skills multiply labor value. So that if you're twice as skilled, you produce twice as much value per hour, right? As a unskilled. That's what twice means. If that's true, then the highly skilled can be more exploited because they produce that much more surplus value. And it has no relationship to the real conflicts that we care about. And the transformation problem, if that's correct, but there's debates about that. You know, to me, it doesn't clarify to workers the sense in which they're exploited. It can just make it, they can say, oh my God, I can't understand. This is ridiculous. Or it's they're taught in a dishonest way. You know, they're not told these complexities. And but on the macro stuff, I don't think you need the transformation problem to extend Marx from the factory to the society. What you need is an account of the capitalists, by virtue of their power and property rights, are able to appropriate the social surplus, and the accumulation process in capitalism, because of competition and forces capitalists to deploy that surplus which they control in the form of profits into endless accumulation. I mean, none of that depends upon the relationship between labor, abstract labor, and profits. It just depends upon the dynamics of capitalists competing with each other in a system based on profits and private ownership of the surplus. And in fact, that's where all Marx's dynamics come from. The only dynamic that doesn't come from that is the falling rate of profit. That's the only part of his argument that really hinges on the labor theory of value. The equalization of rates of profit across sectors, that's a standard kind of idea. That doesn't require the labor theory of value. And the falling rate of profit thesis is a very problematic one. You know, it's not at all obvious that they're saying once you get a highly developed capitalism, that there's some kind of inner tendency for a long-term decline in the rate of profit as opposed to just oscillations. So I don't think you need the dynamics of capitalists trying to globalize the world to penetrate other markets, you know, sort of Luxembourg-type arguments about penetrating non-capitalist parts of the world to make everything a commodity. All of that is just driven by competition and profit maximization under private ownership of the surplus. Yeah.
Sort of on a slightly different topic. I know, you know, people within the Marxist tradition who adhere to the marginal utility theory of value. And I was wondering what you think as far as how that can contribute to their understanding of exploitation, if you frame it as marginal utility.
Or if you
don't think it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's the marginal productivity. That is, the neoclassical economics argument is that workers are paid the equivalent of their marginal productivity. So that each worker is paid exactly what they contribute to production, which is their marginal productivity. And you know,
as is capital.
As is capital. So, but the marginal productivity of workers, the story is an employer is deciding, should I hire one more worker? And let's make it a big employer so there's not lumpiness. You know, so it's a very big employer. I have 10,000 workers. Should I hire 10,001? Well, if I hire this 10,001, I'm going to have to pay that worker $25,000 a year. What is that worker going to produce? Well, if the worker produces $26,000 a year, it's worth hiring. I end up with $1,000 more if I hire that worker. And so it's profitable. So of course I'll hire. Should I hire 10,002 workers? Well, because of declining marginal productivity, given the existing capital stock, you know, that you use things less efficiently as you hire more and more workers to use your facilities, if that's true about your production function, as it were, then at some point you get to a worker in which you're only going to earn $24,000. If you hire them, you say, no, I'm not going to hire them. And that means that the wage equals the marginal product. That's the. And how is that consistent with exploitation? So in the neoclassical framework, exploitation only occurs if workers are producing on the margin, that's this last worker hired idea, more than they're being paid. Now that can happen if you have a company town where workers have no choices, and the employer is there's only one employer. The employer can tell workers, I'm only going to pay you $20,000 or you can starve, and the workers can't go to some other employer. And so a permanent gap can occur. And there could be a reason why, under those conditions, the employer doesn't simply go out and start recruiting more workers to come in to the company town, because workers aren't so stupid as to come into the company town. It's only workers who somehow can't leave. And they can't leave because there are what are in effect socially coercive mechanisms in place. It's too costly for them to leave, for example, because they have family and kin and roots and they won't leave. That would be neoclassical exploitation, where the amount you pay workers is permanently, through some coercive mechanism, somewhere in the system above the marginal product. But if marginal product equals marginal wages, I mean equals wages, then there's no exploitation. Well, the Marxian answer to that, in the absence of the labor theory of value, is that that's a kind of irrelevant observation. That's an observation of the rationality of capitalist employment, to be sure. But the workers still are collectively producing the entire product. It is the product of their labor. The owners are not producing the product. The owners are simply property owners. The stock owners simply own the corporation. They're not working. They're not producing the product. The product is the product of labor, and the owners get a chunk of it. So they get a chunk of the surplus product of labor. That surplus embodies laboring effort. Whether that laboring effort is remunerated in the form of wages or not, the surplus produced by workers embodies laboring effort. And that's all you need to show that it's exploitative. So it's the exploitation of the surplus product of labor, and that, which means it's the exploitation, it's the appropriation of a surplus that embodies labor, that renders that appropriation exploitative. And that's consistent with marginal wages, marginal product equaling wages. So you have to have a notion of surplus, I think, surplus product. As I was explaining to Aichan in the conversation which led to me being a few minutes late, this is to encourage you to come to office hours, because you get engrossed in it. There's really three concepts in play here. Maybe four, I guess. There's surplus product, surplus labor, surplus value, and profits. The kind of what capitalists actually get. I think the first two concepts are the key ones, surplus products and surplus labor. Surplus products embody the labor of the workers who produce the social product, and therefore the surplus product contains surplus labor. That's all you need to have an account of exploitation. And the difference between the way exploitation occurs in capitalism and feudalism has to do with the social mechanisms through which actors in an economic system get access to the surplus, how they manage to appropriate and control the surplus. That's the way to understand it. In capitalism, it comes through private property and exchange. In feudalism, it comes through the direct appropriation of surplus products. In slavery, it comes through the ownership of people and the way you can extract surplus products and surplus labor by virtue of that direct ownership. Okay, I know for some of you in the class who have been around the block several times, so to speak, on these kinds of issues, what I've been laying out here will be pretty clear. For those of you for whom this is your first encounter with ideas like the labor theory of value and exploitation, where you really haven't thought about these issues as abstract theoretical problems before, a lot of this kind of discussion may seem completely obscure. As one iterates over the same themes from different angles, they become more intuitive. Does that answer sort of at least some of your concerns? Okay. Well, we've already kind of begun the rethinking exploitation discussion. In my own work on class, which we will discuss on Wednesday, that is Wednesday's discussion on the problem of complexity of class structures and the particular problem of the middle class, that's where I'm going to, we'll be looking at how I've tried to translate the kinds of things we're talking about now into a specific analysis of class structures. But in my work on it, the problem of exploitation always figured as a theoretical issue that I had to come to terms with one way or another. Marx's class analysis, whatever else is true about it, always links class and exploitation. You know, if you, it's it may not be literally the case that if in any study of class where the word exploitation is invoked, that's a clear signal that the analysis is embedded in the Marxist tradition, but it would be virtually always the case. You know, there'll be occasionally some non-Marxist types who will invoke something about exploitation, but usually that's the code word for clearly labeling the class arguments that are being made as having a Marxian pedigree. But the question then became, once I was no longer comfortable working with the labor theory of value as the language for talking about exploitation, whether or not it was possible to have a systematic and coherent account of class relations intimately connected to the problem of exploitation without having the labor theory of value as the format for developing the concepts. The work that I encountered, which then set me off on a course of clarification, was John Romer's work on class and exploitation. Now, the Romer piece which we assigned, which I assigned and which you've read, is his non-technical, more or less accessible summary of a very difficult book on a general theory of class and exploitation, which is essentially a very mathematized book that has both of these general approaches that he uses, the two-island kind of equilibrium models and the game theory models of exploitation. John Romer was part of this analytical Marxism group. Exploitation was one of the concepts that we worked on for 4 or 5 years in the early years of that group. I found John's strategy really extremely illuminating, and the device of his withdrawal rules, which he explains, that is the idea that whenever you make a claim of exploitation, you're also making a claim that the exploited actors would be better off under alternative rules of the game. That is, a claim about exploitation is always also a claim about non-exploitation, what it would take to be not exploited, and the claim that actors would be better. And that different kinds of exploitation can be identified by different specifications of what would have to be the alternative under which they'd be better off. And the way he sets that up is to, let's imagine that you think of an economy as a game with particular rules, and the rules define what sorts of resources people have control over and what kinds of interactions are permitted. So any economy can be defined that way. That's what we call a mode of production. A mode of production is a set of rules that links different kinds of economic actors to resources of different sorts and tells the actors how they're allowed to interact. So in capitalism, people are allowed to own resources, external natural resources, land, tools, machines, raw materials, but people are not allowed to own each other. Slavery is abolished, but they are allowed to trade as much as they want of anything they own. You can have a labor market, people are allowed to trade their labor services for a wage. You can have a commodities market, people are allowed to trade their products. You have markets, and you have ownership of the external world, but you only have what are called self-ownership of people. People own themselves. That's capitalism and the rules of exchange. So then he says, if you have these rules, and these rules governing assets and interactions, we can then say, we can do as a test for exploitation, if one group of actors, a coalition of people in a particular position, leave the game that they're playing, with their per capita share of some asset, will they be better or worse off? You know, that's the kind of simple version of his withdrawal rules. And if they're better off, that shows that they were exploited under the previous rules. The previous rules rendered them worse off than they would be if they withdrew with their per capita share of some relevant asset. Now, so the test for feudal exploitation is, if feudal peasants withdrew with their personal assets in land, the land which they themselves effectively own and control, not their per capita share of land, but their personal share of land, but their per capita share of labor power, that is, they withdraw with themselves, but the land that they own, will they be better off than they were under feudalism? And the answer is yes, because then they won't have to work for the feudal lord for 3 days a week. They'll just be working on their own land. If workers in capitalism withdrew with their personal assets, just what they themselves own, and their per capita share of people themselves, would they be worse off or better off? And the answer is they'd be worse off. They would starve. That means that they are not feudally exploited in capitalism, because that was the test for feudal exploitation. The test for feudal exploitation is you withdraw with your own labor power, that is the labor power that you yourself as a person have, your per capita share of labor power, you withdraw with your own labor power, but the assets you own in the natural world. If a feudal peasant withdraws from feudalism with the land which they control effectively, where they have effective real control, the peasant plus, and their per capita share of labor power, namely themselves, they'll be better off. But workers in capitalism would be worse off under those rules. Yeah.
I'm just trying to think about these examples, but it seems, I'm just wondering where exactly they withdraw to. Are they withdrawing into sort of like a make-believe vacuum or something, or do they withdraw into another mode of production?
They're withdrawing into alternative rules of the game. The metaphor of withdrawal is just changing the rules of the game.
And do they withdraw into a socially reproducible mode of production?
He isn't asking either the historical question.
But it's not historical.
It would be in the peasant's case, it's withdrawing into simple commodity production. That is, you leave feudalism where you work part of the day for the lord and part of the day for yourself, and the part of the day you work for yourself you use to feed your family and to trade things in the market, which happened in feudalism. So you just leave feudalism by producing for your family and for the market with the resources you have, because you no longer have the obligation to share your labor power with the feudal lord. He's not asking the political question, could you do this without destroying the world? You know, well, the knights, the feudal lord has enough coercive power to prevent you from doing it. And he's not even really asking the question, which is a little more subtle, well, under the existing technologies of feudalism, it's so easy for a group of people to band together to become knights that unless you have protection from your own knights, you're going to immediately get, you know, taken over by some other group of peasants who will suddenly become knights. That is, one view about feudalism is that it was an historically inevitable form of class relations given the nature of the technologies. That's the socially reproducible part. He's not asking whether it would be feasible to actually have simple commodity production. That is, people owning their own means of production and selling stuff on the market without capitalism, without lords. If the peasants tried to do that, probably throughout much of the feudal era, lords would have reemerged anyway. Probably. That's the historical materialist claim. But he's using this as a logical test for whether exploitation of a particular sort exists. So that's Romer's withdrawal rules approach. Now, I found that, when I first encountered it, very thought-provoking. And it led me to have a clearer idea of what it was about exploitation that rendered it explanatory in a sociological sense. So this is not the specific economic sense that classical Marxian political economy would have thought about exploitation, but just what is sociologically interesting about it. And it seemed to me that really what's sociologically interesting about it, and what sociologists have always thought was interesting, was the way in which exploitation defines a very distinctive kind of conflict of interests, which is what the withdrawal rules was meant to illustrate. The withdrawal rules would prove that there was a conflict of interests because there's an alternative in which people would be better off. And eventually that led me to clarify the concept of exploitation in terms of what I call, you know, these three basic principles, three criteria, which if all three are present, exploitation is present. And as I began thinking about that, I also remembered from my childhood, literally, this is the story of the Shmoo, which was in the comics. You know, my dad was a big fan of Little Abner, this American comic strip that went from the 30s into the 60s. And we had a book about the Shmoos around the house when I was little. It's been reissued. If any of you are enamored with the Shmoo from Amazon, you can get a complete set of all the Shmoo cartoons. They're a nice little, not too expensive edition. And the Shmoo story then seemed to really clarify to me, anyway, what it was about exploitation that both had a moral issue, raised moral questions, and really clarified the nature, the specificity of the nature of interests in play. And as I reread this Shmoo story and then decided to use it in a paper, in trying to think through the logic of the Shmoo story, it also ultimately helped me understand this distinction between exploitation and non-exploitative oppression. So just terminologically, in terms of those words, I'm not saying that exploitation isn't oppressive. So the full-blown label should probably be exploitative oppression and non-exploitative oppression. I'm drawing a contrast between two forms of oppression. But then, rhetorically, just to make the language simpler, I talk about exploitation versus oppression. But you should always understand what I mean when I just use the word oppression by itself, I mean non-exploitative oppression, without the implication that exploitation is itself not an example of oppression. Now that, I think, is an important distinction, and it's a distinction which has lots of ramifications for all sorts of other questions we might want to study, besides class issues. So let me just briefly restate what those criteria are and explain how they are deployed with respect to this contrast. Okay. The first principle is what I call the inverse interdependent welfare principle. Inverse interdependent welfare principle. Okay, so this is a way of describing a social relation between people. People are interdependent. That's what a relation means. There's some interdependency between people. They have a relation in which the well-being of one is connected through that relation to the well-being of another. Now, there are many ways in which those interconnections could vary. When you are in a family and you deeply care about each other, you could say there is a positive interdependent welfare principle. The well-being of one member of the family is interdependent upon the well-being of another. When my children are doing badly, I do badly. There's a wonderful little cartoon that my parents-in-law have on their refrigerator, which shows a father and his daughter playing catch. And the daughter asks the father, "If you could wish anything, what would it be?" And he says, "I would wish you a life of happiness and fulfillment." And she says, "No, I mean something for you." And he said, "I did wish something for me." Now, you know, it's a simple story, but it does reflect the positive welfare principle, interdependent welfare principle. That's what we mean by love, what we mean by reciprocity, what we mean by living in a community where you care deeply about the well-being of others, so your own sense of well-being really does depend upon the well-being of others. Okay, that's one form of welfare interdependency. Another form is inverse interdependent welfare. And that's a form of interdependence that is a little bit less comfortable. It means my sense of well-being, my actual well-being, depends causally upon your deprivations in one way or another. I do better when you do worse. Indeed, in order for me to do better, you have to do worse. Now, there's a real connection between our welfare, but it's inverse. That's the first criteria. The second criteria is what I refer to as the resource exclusion principle. This is a diagnosis. This is a diagnosis about the underlying explanation for the first relation. The second relation helps to explain the first relation. The resource exclusion principle helps to explain how it comes to pass that my well-being depends upon your deprivations. It says that the reason why I prosper by virtue of your deprivations is because I am in a position to exclude you from access to certain key resources. If I lost that capacity, it would no longer be the case that my well-being depended upon your deprivation. This is what distinguishes the exploitation oppression problem from simple competition. It's true when you're playing a game of chess that your victory depends upon your opponent's defeat, and your pleasure, you know, depends upon their disappointment, right? So there is an inverse interdependence of welfare in any competitive game. But it doesn't depend upon your ability to exclude them from access to some resource. It just depends upon your winning in a competition. That's why we would call cheating. If you cheat, you're in effect excluding them from access to a resource. Cheating is a different form of relation than just ordinary competition. Resource exclusion is the central mechanism underlying the inverse interdependence. Different kinds of resources, therefore, lead to different kinds of inverse interdependence, different forms of oppression. That's the second principle. The third principle, the effort appropriation principle, is a diagnosis of one of the pathways by which the resource exclusion principle leads to interdependence. Resource exclusion is the fundamental problem. That's property relations, ownership of means of production, exclusion of people from access to resources. But that can affect the interdependence in more than one way. And one of the ways it can affect interdependence is that it enables the excluder to control and appropriate the labor effort of the excluded. Now, when all three of these are present, you have exploitation. When only the first two are present, you have non-exploitative oppression. The iconic example I use to explain that contrast, which of course is historically a caricature of what of real history, but nevertheless I think illustrates the point, would be the following. When you have a peasant community that has common grazing land, their well-being depends in significant extent upon their access to that common land. That was referred to as the commons in discussions of peasant societies. So peasants have their own plots, but they also share a commons. And the commons provides an important collective resource which enables peasant standards of living to be higher than they would otherwise be. A landlord comes along and through the use of power, coercion, fences off the commons and takes it over for the landlord's exclusive use. The peasants are excluded from access to that resource. The closing of the commons was one of the decisive processes in late medieval England, early modern England, that heralded in the beginnings the transition from feudal agriculture to early forms of capitalist agriculture. So at this point, the first two conditions have been met, right? The welfare of the feudal, of the landlord is improved at the expense of the peasant through the exclusion of access to a resource. So the first two conditions are met. The landlord then hires back a number of the starving peasants to work the land as shepherds or herdsmen or planters, depending upon agricultural labor, depending upon what the commons land is going to be used for. Those peasants are now exploited as well as oppressed. That is, the lord is now able to appropriate their labor effort, not just benefit from their exclusion. Now, that might not happen, right? One reason why the lord might want to take over the common land, and this also has happened historically, is because they wanted to use it for recreation. They wanted to use the forest, which was a classic kind of common land for hunting. Throughout much of human history, the forest wasn't owned by anybody. Anybody could go into the forest and hunt deer or whatever. One of the things that happens in history is that rich and powerful landlords want exclusive use of the forest for their own hunting. And it's really more in the spirit of recreation than it is providing for means of subsistence. But they don't hire the excluded peasants to become their hunters. They just use it for themselves. That's just oppression without exploitation. Oppression without exploitation is, of course, still morally condemnable, but it has a very different sociological quality than does exploitation. And a key difference, and this is, I think, a really crucial point and why exploitation is a sociologically rich concept, is once oppressing classes also exploit the excluded, that gives the excluded power, the excluded, the exploited power. Exploitation defines a very complex kind of social relation in which the exploited have a form of power that the oppressed or the merely oppressed lack. Namely, that because we are human beings, conscious agents, capable of controlling our own effort, we are never mere machines, mere robots. We always have the capacity to kill ourselves, which, of course, oppressed people have done at times. They've resisted knowing that it would mean their death, but they would rather do that than submit. That is not an historically rare thing to happen. Because of that, our control over effort acts as a constraint on the activity of the exploiter. The exploiter needs the exploited. There's a dependency of the exploiter on the exploited. And that's why one should think of this as interdependence, not just sheer one-directional domination. It is interdependence. And that's been a resource of the exploited throughout history that's used to constrain the behavior of exploiters. It's reflected, for example, in slavery in the stereotype of the lazy slave, right? The slave that lacks motivation, shuffles along, doesn't expend effort. Well, that is a form of resistance. It's not that slaves lost human agency and just because they were so beaten down they had no energy left for work. It's because shirking, looking incompetent, acting stupid, making mistakes is a form of resistance. Exploitation confers power on the exploited in a way that a simple oppression doesn't. It means that if you have a situation of simple oppression, I'm a landowner, I'm benefiting from your exclusion, I have no use for you, and you're causing trouble because you don't like being excluded, I have available a rational solution. Rational in the sense that it serves my interest, which is to exterminate you. Genocide is a solution to the conflicts generated by simple oppression. but not to the conflicts generated by exploitation. And this is captured, I think, in folk sayings. I mean, I point this out in the chapter which was assigned, but in American history in the 1850s, this is before the Civil War, there was a folk expression that emerged. It was actually, I'm told, a general in the American cavalry who was of Irish descent. So this is a folk saying that is an American folk saying that comes from an Irish general in American military during the Indian Wars. He invented the expression, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Now that's a horrible, obviously. Doesn't need commentary. It's no different from a Nazi slogan about Jews. Absolutely, morally indistinguishable. The only good Indian is a dead Indian. However horrible we find that saying, it makes sense. You know, nobody who knows American history would find it perplexing that an American fighting the Indians would say the only good Indian is a dead Indian. We understand why what such a saying means. The comparable saying for a relation of exploitation doesn't make any sense. You couldn't say the only good slave is a dead slave. You know, Southern culture could not have developed that expression. They could have the only good slave is a docile slave, is a peaceful slave, is an obedient slave. Those make sense. But the only good slave is a dead slave doesn't make any sense. That reflects the fact that there's a constraint on the treatment of slaves imposed upon slaveholders, just as there is a constraint on their treatment of horses. You know, you don't beat your horse to death because you're destroying your capital. Slave owners became much less brutal in the course of the 19th century. That is, the use of physical torture as a disciplining device for slaves declined in the course of the 19th century because the effect of abolition of the international slave trade raised the value of slaves, made them a more expensive form of property. And therefore, it made it much more costly for slave owners to destroy their own property through brutal behavior. That reflects, again, the capacity of slaves to resist, in effect, to demand better treatment, by virtue of the fact that the slave owner needed them, and that their expenditure of effort was a valuable product for the, produced valuable products for the slave owner. Now, all of that description, to refer back to our earlier discussion, came without any reference to the labor theory of value. All that was needed for this was an argument about the interests of owners of means of production in the extraction of effort from the users of those means of production because of their property rights in the products of labor. That's the elements you need in order to get that specification of the relationship between exploitation and oppression. The kind of take-home message that I want to just for you to mull about is then this notion that exploitation is a distinct type of power relation, and it's one in which the elites, the powerful, become dependent and need the powerless. This is then a point of entry to a very interesting general theme, which is sometimes referred to as the power of the powerless. Too often, I think, particularly in left and critical social theory, there is a pure victimology of domination, you know, which is, of course, understandable. The harms imposed upon subordinate groups are terrible. But I think the notion of the power of the powerless is as fundamental to our understanding of processes of transformation rather than just processes of degradation.
But the pure victim is still totally applicable to the...
Yes, I think, I mean, the oppressed can still resist. You know, Native Americans resisted their expropriation from the land, but they could only resist through violent resistance to the depredations. It quickly escalated to really, you know, violent, destructive And victimhood also sometimes suggests passivity, which is false. They're certainly not passive. One final just little comment. I've elaborated this in terms of material economic exploitation and oppression. I think these basic three criteria, inverse interdependence, resource exclusion, effort appropriation, can be applied to many other domains of human interaction, not simply class. And I haven't thought deeply about this. I do think it's ideas that are implicit in various sociological accounts of sexuality and of culture, but I think it's something that's worth pursuing. So for example, on the sexuality issue, we can talk about the distinction between sexual oppression and sexual exploitation. In sexual exploitation, the exploiter needs the sexual effort of the exploited. They depend upon it for their own sexual interests. I mean, I'm going to just use a direct linguistic translation, you know, replacing the word material or class with sexual in each instance. So in a heterosexist society with male domination, heterosexual men who exploit women still depend for their own sexual interests on the sexual activity of women. That's why the withdrawal of that sexual activity is a threat to men. And that's why in the Greek story, is it Orestia? What's the Greek?
Aristophanes.
The story about the Trojan women.
Antigone.
Is it Antigone? I forget which of the... Antigone is that's about the brother, right? Well, whatever.
Antigone is the one that they go to war and the women...
And the women withdraw their sexual services to men as a way of fighting. Well, women have that capacity to fight back. And this is expressed in all sorts of, you know, popular cultural images of sexuality, the battle of the sexes, the woman who uses the fact that she controls sexual services within a domination relationship as leverage to get things from a man, to force some compliance to various other family norms that she wants. So it is certainly a source of power to be, quote, sexually exploited that would be absent if you were merely sexually oppressed. Now, what would be sexual oppression? The relationship of heterosexual men to homosexuality, and many times in history, is one of sexual oppression. They want to stamp it out. They want to prevent it from having a social expression. They want to impose sanctions upon it, and indeed have throughout much of contemporary history. In the case of sexual oppression, you can have this, you can have the little test of, it's the analogy of the only good Indian is a dead Indian. I mean, when European settlers came to North America, if they could have snapped their fingers the day before they arrived, they were asked, do you want to have a lot of people there, or do you want the continent to be without anybody? Snap your fingers and there'll be no people on the continent. Well, snapping your fingers would make life a lot easier. It was an accident of the Ice Age of 15,000 years ago that there was a land bridge between Asia and North America. And if there hadn't been a land bridge between Asia and North America, this would have been an unpopulated continent. Because 20,000 years ago, there were no people in North America. And it just happened that geology made that possible. It would not have had a big effect on the development of European civilization and its eventual traversing of the Atlantic if the Bering Sea had been a little deeper and hadn't frozen over, right? That's pure contingency. North America could have been without people, and it would have made the settlement of the continent much simpler. Well, that's the test of oppression, right? That if you snap your fingers and the people disappear, you're better off. That's not true if you exploit them. Well, consider the heterosexual oppression of homosexuality. If you're a heterosexist homophobe and you could snap your finger and have homosexuality simply disappear from the human menu of sexual orientation, your sexual interests would be advanced because you wouldn't have to be troubled by this other form of sexuality that you want to exclude. So you can see that you can talk about sexual oppression and sexual exploitation, and it's why homosexuality is has been much more harshly treated as a social form, and the cultural preconditions for the struggles against it were very long in coming, and still precarious, of course, and some parts of the world completely absent. One could make the same kind of point about cultural oppression and cultural exploitation. If you think about Native Americans and the cultural oppression of Native Americans took the form of efforts to stamp out Native American culture by, for example, forcing families to send their children to government schools where they were prohibited from speaking the language. That was an effort to simply eliminate that cultural form altogether. And the idea of assimilation under that model was the world would be a better place without Native American culture. Get rid of it. That's pure cultural oppression. In the last 50 years and increasingly, there is a celebration of Native American culture. There's an appropriation for commercial purposes of all sorts of iconography from Native Americans. There's New Age religion, which taps into the spirituality of Mother Earth and Native American spiritual traditions and uses it for advancing the interests of New Age gurus and commercial interests connected to that. That's cultural exploitation. Now, it's exploitation. The cultural effort of Native Americans are being appropriated and used for the advantage of the dominant culture in ways which is harmful because it cheapens and degrades the central dignity of those cultural products. Nevertheless, it's better to be culturally exploited than to be culturally oppressed. That it's under those cultural exploitation relations, there's greater space for resistance and for reproduction of cultural forms because you're not under the kind of cultural genocidal pressures of the dominant culture that was attempting to simply eradicate its vestiges. So along with cultural exploitation, there's come a revitalization of Native American language, the creation of Native American cultural schools that are restoring some of the craft and artistic traditions, and simultaneously with being exploited, it's also being reproduced. So one could have an account of cultural exploitation and oppression that parallel the economic one. Okay, well, I incorrectly said last time that the second class on exploitation, we would wrap it up very quickly. We would have more time for general discussion. Should we not take a... Is it okay to not take a break and just open this up for general discussion now? There's a talk by one of the hip-hop... There's a hip-hop sociologist who's giving a talk, and it's a potential person that conceivably you might hire at UW. I'm part of his hip-hop studies initiative. And he's giving a talk in the law school. I don't know why it's in the law school. It's called Hip-Hop in the Digital Age at the law school at noon, and Craig Watkins, and I want to go to that lecture because I'm on the University Committee for Hip-Hop Studies for various reasons, which I can explain to you on another occasion. So I do want to stop, let's say at 7 to 12 will be enough time for me to get up to law school. Yeah.
About sexual exploitation, I don't see the homosexual analogy entirely because there's no competitive element. Following the logic of the argument, if sex with women is the resource, in the case of Native Americans and Europeans, there was a competitive element over control of the land. But homosexual men, by definition, are not in competition with heterosexual men for that resource of sex with women.
Right, unless you consider a symbolic issue as being salient in that repression. That is, that the reason for heterosexual men wanting to have a monopoly on the possibility of sexuality is because of the symbolic assault that variation implies to them. that, you know, you'd have to give some argument of that character, and that might give specificity to the logic of these categories, in which the nature of competition that you correctly identified as being present in the economic oppression scenario might not be the best way to think about it.
Because that symbolic issue is outside, is a separate analytical set of issues from the strictly economic understanding of exploitation versus oppression, I would suggest.
Yeah, but the sexual is also outside of the strictly economic. So the question is whether sexuality, because of its psychological and identity salience, invokes then symbolic competition that doesn't imply a real competition.
Okay.
Your strictly competitive view, of course, would have, I mean, to really carry this beyond where probably we're on safe ground, male heterosexual opposition to lesbian sex could be viewed as competitive because that's women competing for women.
Right.
I don't know if I would want to carry this analogy out that far, although as a way of beginning to think about it, one might just see if that produced interesting insights or it was just wordplay. Yeah, Gary.
Well, I was going to say something about the possibility that it might make sense because depending on the culture, like take for example the fact that a lot of people who demonize homosexuality are Christian as well. Not all people, but a lot of people. And so the idea is that there are two cultures competing and they believe that homosexuality is not genetic, but it's culture, and it can be spread, and the goal in life is not the goal, but one of the main goals is to save everybody and to go to heaven. And so if not so many people are saved, then it's a problem. If more people aren't saved, then it's a bigger problem. If everybody, if it spreads, then everybody is not saved, then that's the biggest problem. So the idea is to get rid of this competing culture for a specific reason.
Right.
So I see that as making some sense, at least.
And it's an incredibly interesting topic from the trying to sort out the nature of the categories. The relationship between homophobia and religion is very close, but it's not always clear what the direction is. That is, it's not always clear whether people's deepest commitments are religious and therefore they're homophobic, or religion is very attractive to homophobic people because it makes sense of their homophobia, or both. I mean, I don't, you know, there's no reason to assume it's one way or the other. It could be that the religious symbolic face of this is a rationalization for the primary psychosexual issues around sexuality and the way identities get formed around sexuality, either positively or negatively. So homophobia is a negative identity. That is, it's a formation of your identity around sexuality negatively with respect to an alternative rather than just positively as an affirmation of what you find your own sexual orientation to be. Joe?
If you think about it just purely as sexual transactions, isn't it kind of against the heterosexist interest to oppose male homosexuality? Because male homosexuality decreases competition,
right,
for the
heterosexual
transactions.
Right. Yeah, so that's similar to the point that Matt was making, that the purely competitive logic around the material resource didn't seem to really apply the same way to the sexual context. So that the notion of sexual exploitation still works, that is, the sense in which a heterosexist man depends upon the sexual effort of a woman, and therefore, if there's an exploitative relationship, that is, one is dominating the other with respect to that activity, one sees the interdependence. But the oppressive side didn't seem to work as simply as in the economic, because the question of competition doesn't work in the same way. And what that would mean is if you find intuitively attractive this kind of distinction between oppression and exploitation, then there's a nice kind of theoretical provocation here to refine the notion of oppression with respect to sexuality And maybe the same issue applies with respect to culture. We have to think about it. To see what it is that renders sexual oppression distinctive. And figuring out this competitive aspect might be an important part of it.
Could I just quickly interject something?
Yeah.
I was going to say that actually I was directly responding to that point by saying that, in other words, the act that it doesn't have to be, I mean, you're focusing on the idea that it has to be that women are the actual resource, whereas the resource could be something else, like the idea that good works, because the whole idea is to, the more good works you do, the likelier is to go to heaven or something like that, and the more people you save, the more, I don't know, I mean, I'm just saying that maybe if there's another resource there that is actually competing with this other resource, so.
Adam, you've been, you look like you want to say.
Well, I know that you're positing it as sort of just an intellectual exercise in
right.
terms of just saying that there might be another resource, but in that particular instance, then it doesn't explain why the same types of attacks aren't leveled against atheists or agnostics.
The same type of what?
Attacks are leveled against atheists or agnostics within a male heterosexual culture that are leveled against
homosexuals. You're saying that...
I'm saying that particular resource isn't necessarily a good analysis because you don't have... For one, you do have homosexuals who are also Christian that simply don't buy the doctrine of particular interpretations of sodomy, and then the other,
okay. and so those,
and then you also you don't have heterosexual males leveling the same types of oppressive attacks against those in our society who are atheists or agnostics, who arguably, you know, are not engaging in some sort of celebratory sort of activities in terms of Christianity.
So what you're saying is that those atheists and agnostics, I mean, in this, of course, you know. Debate here, are gay, right?
No, I'm just saying that if they're heterosexual and they're atheist or agnostic, they're not saved either, but the same types of attacks aren't leveled against them. So using Christianity or some sort of Christian notion of salvation as the commodity being pursued is not necessarily valid in this case.
So you're saying that atheists are never oppressed?
No, what he's saying is that line of thinking that the resource you're looking for is salvation wouldn't apply to a atheist or agnostic that is also heterosexist.
Well, I think here's the way to see this.
I'm saying it doesn't work for the issue of homosexuality. Because
so,
if that were the resource, then you would have to see the same types of oppression right. that you see with homosexuals.
So here's
the
agnostic. Well, you could argue the following. So this diagnosis says that the true relational problem at play here is religious, of which then the homophobia is a symptom. It's one manifestation, is what your claim is.
It could be.
Now, right. I'm just asking.
Yeah.
But one could also say that the reason why at this point in history that's the target for religious exclusivism and religious oppression is because homosexuality is a social force, a social movement. If atheists got their act together and became a powerful social movement and were effectively getting In God We Trust off of currency and were effectively arguing for the removal of tax-exempt status from churches, you know, if the movement for a God-free society became a collective social movement, then there would be an awful lot of attack, including, you know, violent attack directed at those groups by the same forces which are currently targeting homosexuals. that would be the counterclaim then.
But the assumption there is that atheists and agnostics and such don't have some sort of organized movement within society
their
homosexuals do.
But their culture is actually being oppressed to a degree, like.
But you don't see the same type. Nobody's out there saying that atheists and agnostics can't get married or that they can't have civil unions. You're not seeing the same types of complete removals of human rights at the level that you do
right.
for homosexuals.
Well, that's
so. I mean, I just think
that's because they already have the right. So, I mean, are people going to be calling for removal of rights?
Well, the equivalent, the analogy would not be that atheists can't marry because what's in play is not sex and reproduction. What the equivalent would be, the state of Texas has to include creationism in high school science books. That would be, that is a denial of rights to science. I mean, it's removal of the rights to control the teaching of science by believers in secular science. Right. So that's and that's how it's viewed. You know, the one case where the ACLU is not defending creationists and the like is the insistence that it be included in science textbooks. And if that's what the creationists would like to do, if they could do it, they just, they tried it and they came close, and they invent new labels.
Yeah, I'm not saying that the issue of Christianity doesn't come into play in issues like these. I just don't think that the entire issue of homosexuality hinges on Christian versus right. non-Christian doctrine.
I didn't say that. That's one of the things that could be that maybe we're looking at when you criticize this as being, you know, a form of oppression.
Sure.
That it actually may be the case that for some instances, and maybe in right now in the United States, a lot of the instances, it might be related to religion, and that there's a different resource that we're talking about that's not related to directly to sexuality, but a resource, a different resource.
Right.
I mean, like, what argument would you put forth that explains it that doesn't have to do with oppression?
I wouldn't necessarily say it doesn't have to do with oppression. I would just say that the research is probably something more like gender identity. Homosexuality challenges standard notions of gender identity that heterosexualists generally feel like they have ownership over.
And it may be, of course, that if we played with this idea enough, we would decide, you know, the oppression-exploitation analogy from the economic really has too many slippages that to import it into the sexual domain of sexual relations and to call it sexual exploitation and sexual oppression actually is obscuring what's specific about it, the psychodynamic infrastructure and identity infrastructure of these things may be driving these hatreds and exclusions in ways that really doesn't bear analogy with class. Or one could figure out ways in which it does. So what we're engaged in here is a kind of dialectic around the problem of concept formation. We're trying to see if a concept which seems to work pretty powerfully and compellingly in one domain, the distinction between oppression and exploitation around economic and material conditions, whether it can be usefully used to capture some crucial mechanisms and differences within a different domain. And then this particular discussion about possibly the implication of religion as it impinges on it is a way of trying to get at some specificities here. You know, so whether or not this is the right way to play that out, I don't think it's so important for our present purposes. But issues along other dimensions of this. Let's move on to other. Yeah, and then David.
I have a question. Because I have a problem with the category of exclusion. If we thought the point A, the inverse interdependent welfare principle, mm-hmm. If we are thinking the society with this category, for me, is in contradiction with the category of exclusion, because I understand the category of exclusion, the people that is out of the society. And here the exclusion will be the oppressive people that is integrated to the society, but in different way than the dominant class. I don't know if I am clear. Because when you read sociological analysis about the category of exclusion is to refer to the people that is out of the society. And if we are thinking the society in this way of the inverse interdependent welfare principle, all the people are integrated but in different ways.
Okay, so, yes, I understand your point exactly. Note, the second criteria is not social exclusion principle, it's resource exclusion principle. So I'm simply saying that the mechanism by which these people who live in the same society, why some people have their welfare negatively related to others, is because they're excluded from access to certain important resources. Now, sometimes that exclusion can be so severe because the resource is so central to social, to their reproduction, that exclusion from a particular resource becomes very close to social exclusion. In the case of Native Americans, for example, their exclusion from resource from the land meant they had to move geographically west. Sometimes they were actually forcibly moved west, that is, they were taken west. Other times they just migrated once it became clear that they could not recapture their land. And so they did, in a sense, remove themselves from the society within which they had that negative interdependence. There are some cases where this was, in American history, U.S. history, monstrously gross even at the time. The most notorious case was the removal of the Cherokees from Georgia and, you know, sort of the southern, I guess it's mostly Georgia is what at least it's known as. Did I mention the Cherokees at some other point as an illustration of something here? I have it in my head that I recently was talking about the Cherokees in some way. This is probably not an episode familiar to people who didn't go to elementary school and high school in the United States, where this is one of the things you learn. The Cherokees were a Native American population who Christianized. They all converted to Christianity, and they became settled farmers in Georgia. They adopted European clothing. They were the most assimilated Native American community. They had, you know, a political structure that was very well developed with elected leaders. You know, it was the whole thing. And they thought by buying in fully to the form of American institutions that they would be safe from the depredations. Because they were in the South, they even became slave owners. So the Cherokee Nation in Georgia and other places in the South had black slaves. But the white settlers in the area wanted their land, just like they wanted other land. And because they were the native indigenous settlers there, they had the best land. I mean, they knew where the good water was, where the good fields were. They were farmers. They, in fact, did occupy some of the best land in that region. So a lot of conflict occurred as white settlers tried to move in and kick them out, even though they were fully Christianized, settled, non-nomadic. Andrew Jackson in 1830-something, 34 maybe, decided that the entire Cherokee Nation had to be removed west of the Mississippi. So this indigenous population that thought they were fully settled were forced by the military to move 1,500 miles west. So now the Cherokee are all in Oklahoma. That's where they are located. They have become a fairly prosperous tribe because of oil and casinos. And there's a hugely painful fight in the courts because of the subpopulation called Black Cherokees. So they went to Oklahoma with their slaves. They took their black slaves with them. The black descendants of the slaves of the Cherokees are not recognized by the Cherokee tribe as Cherokee. So they don't have rights to the revenues from the casinos and the oil. You know, if you want to talk about a complicated set of oppression and exploitation. So that's a case where it really was exclusion in the strong sense. They were completely removed from the dominant society. Let's see if other people...
I wanted to respond to that story. I just want to ask a question. Was this the case? I don't know too many details about it, but is it the case that they were not allowing the white settlers to actually move into that territory? Or were they allowing them to move into that territory, but just because they were mostly Indian, but...
Well, the Cherokee wouldn't allow white settlers to take their land. The Cherokee claimed that they owned all the land.
They owned all this land and they wouldn't let them go past a certain boundary?
No, they could travel through, I assume. But they did not want the Cherokee Nation maintained, it had sovereignty over, its nation, and that this, they were settled and this was their fields and their... And the forests were their forests, and white settlers said, no, this is good land, we want it.
So because of the concept of lands to Indians, which is that we don't just own this plot of land, we own this whole thing, is
I don't know, I don't know the details of the juridical fight, but it was, the general historical account is that the Cherokees had what would be normally considered a legitimate claim to this land, and the white settlers were essentially wanting to appropriate it like they had done with every other Native American community, and that the federal government came in on the side of the white settlers for purely racist reasons. Now, whether there was also a secondary question about the Cherokees claiming ownership of land which they didn't, quote, truly own because, it was not being tilled, I don't know. Those details.
Trail of Tears.
Trail of Tears is the removal.
I have a question related to that. So I'm just trying to think about exploitation and oppression related to people who are on welfare and people in prison. There are whole industries that are dependent on people being on welfare and people in prison, but they're not... they're not appropriating their labor at all. But if you're to ask like social workers or people or like guards in prison if they would want prisoners to go away or welfare recipients to go away, they probably wouldn't. Is that oppression or is that exploitation?
That's a good question. Let me make a preliminary point. To say that people on welfare are oppressed but not exploited doesn't actually mean that they don't serve some other function in the system. So the existence of a poor, marginalized population can serve important ideological functions. It can be a way of disciplining people who are exploited but have the fear of falling into that category, for example. So it may be that the simple test that the American, African-American, marginalized population, American capitalism would do better if they simply disappeared, and that's the kind of test that they're oppressed but not exploited. That might not be fully true if they serve an ideological purpose, to have a dangerous class, in quotes, on the margins of society concentrated in the central city helps to reproduce a certain kind of racism and a certain kind of fear, which is important for stabilizing a social order, one might argue. So but that wouldn't render them economically exploited. One might say they are then being symbolically exploited. They're economically oppressed and symbolically exploited. That is, they're being used, their human activity is being used symbolically as a way of serving the interests of particular categories. Now, in terms of welfare recipients and social workers or prisoners and prison guards, those categories have a direct economic interest in certain activities, just as the military that was involved in the Indian Wars had an interest in there being Indians because you needed Indians in order to fight them. and they were paid to fight them. So I think, I'm not sure if the way to then to comprehend that kind of relationship is to say they were exploiting them. They were using them in order to get paid by a third party, the state, to perform guard labor. But the guard labor is essentially the, they had an interest in the oppressive relation because they're being paid to oppress or to service in the case of social workers. I'm not sure if the oppression exploitation language is the way to think about those kinds of interconnections.
Okay. And then just a, just to follow up on that, like they're having programs like workfare where, you know, employers can have welfare recipients and not pay them as workers, and then they have prison labor in a lot of industries. Now, would that be exploitation?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And workfare is an example of an effort to render certain categories of labor that were not exploitable. You know, it's an effort, the idea of welfare to work, work first. The idea was that there are barriers to these people becoming exploited that are created by the nature of our welfare institutions, the prior ones, that those prior institutions made it hard for single mothers without training and without skills to be exploited, and will create new institutions to facilitate their exploitation. And that essentially means that, you know, one way of interpreting it is that capitalism in general works better when more of the population is exploited rather than just oppressed. Oppression generates, pure oppression generates social overhead costs that can be quite expensive. And all things being equal, capitalists would rather exploit people than just oppress them. Because when you exploit them, you get something from the control over them. You get labor and effort. But sometimes that's not possible because of economic constraints. So you end up with a surplus population, which can become very expensive to deal with. The American prison system is hugely expensive. I mean, it's a terribly inefficient way of dealing with the problem of technological change, globalization, skilled job mismatches, I mean, all the reasons that you might want to use to explain why do we have such a large marginalized poor population in the United States compared to other comparably developed countries. This is an expensive solution, the lock-em-up solution. And we're kind of locked into that pathway for various reasons. And it could be that alternatives might be less expensive but more politically dangerous, because they might open up a greater willingness of people to rethink the relationship between state and economy, for example.
Tatiana. I have only one question. The interdependent character of the first principle explains the relation between groups, or it could explain relations between individuals?
Both. Yeah, I mean, I think these concepts can be applied. I think ultimately we're talking about people, real people being exploited. The notion that a group is exploited but not its members doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, but for example, if you think that it can explain the relation between heterosexual and homosexual groups, right? But then inside those groups, you have different positions, for example, in relation, related to their religious position. So if you can apply just to the individuals, just to make differences inside of the groups,
right,
or how to include new variables in the relationship.
So this is a theme that we're going to come up against many times. It has to do with what is the fundamental unit of analysis? Is it individuals or is it more aggregated categories? Sometimes more aggregated categories are simply summary statements about a population of individuals, all of whom share a given trait. Other times, an aggregate category is actually a category that has, to use philosophical language, and ontological standing in its own right. I don't think the category homosexuals is an aggregate category that has standing in its own right. It's an attribute of individuals that a group that people share, and it's an attribute that leads them all as individuals to experience some of the same things in a world that is homophobic, that is just as the attribute being a woman in a world that's structured around gender relations leads all women to have some kinds of experiences and relations and dilemmas in common by virtue of that relation. But I don't think the category woman is a group. That is, ontologically, there's not a category woman that acts. Women act, have experiences, have lives, structured by something they have in common by virtue of the social structure in which they live. Now, class is a little different in that respect, because classes form collective associations. So we have a notion of class formation, where classes become collective actors, not just individual experiences. I still give primacy to the individual in the sense that the collective action only, you can only talk about it by virtue of the fact that the members of that association, that collective formation, share a set of common experiences by virtue of their relations. The kind of sophisticated view here is I'm not a methodological individualist. I don't think you can dissolve those aggregate collective categories into the attributes of individuals, but I still think they rest upon them. They have foundations in the lives and locations and relations that impact individuals. But I want to get to the hip-hop lecture. And be sure to send me feedback about the way our discussions are going. So since the first time, we haven't broken down into small groups. And if nobody ever objects to anything, then inertia will rule. So let me know what you think.